Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Hello, and welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council program today. My name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and you are all in for a special treat today. If you could please turn off your cell phones, our program today is being recorded both for KSKA and KACN-TV. So if you wouldn't mind just turning off your cell phones, it will help during these rebroadcasts. We'd like to thank William Toyer for doing the recording for KSKA, and today's program will be available for you to download on KSKA Public Radio's website. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the podcast at the bottom of the page. Katie Parrish is here with KACN-TV, and you can watch these programs at GCI and Matsu Cable Station 95, over-air Anchorage and Matsu Digital 33.3, and via satellite and dish network channel 38. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs Council, if you wouldn't mind raising your hand. Do we have any new folks? Wow, okay. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming and fighting the traffic and parking downtown. If you like this program, please consider coming to our next one as well, where we are going to be hosting Ambassador Edward Peck, who will be discussing the Arab Spring, geography, history, and religion, how it shapes a vital region. And he is one of our liveliest, provocative speakers in our network, so it's going to be a great program. Also, if you are a student, if you wouldn't mind standing and being recognized, we love having the students here. Great. Thank you. It's so great to see all of you. Thanks to BP for sponsoring the student lunches for this program and the rest of our series. And I'd also like to take a quick minute to thank Billy Shore for going out to West High School this morning, where he spoke to about 50 students at West High. And I saw a couple other students today. We have our high school gifted mentored internship student, Kale Clippendale, over there. Hello, welcome. He is part of the school business partnerships program, which we sponsor. And Jonathan Taylor, our new writer from UAA. It's so good to see you. He'll be taking notes. Hi, Jonathan. At this time, I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left, we have Bill Popp, president of Anchorage Economic and Development Corporation, a partner in this program today. And to his right, Mr. Garrett Wong, who's the chairman of our board, and he makes my job very pleasant, and it's so great to have him here. And to his right, Pat Yak, who is vice president of APTI and also on our board of directors. Pat.
I just want to echo something that Lisa said. We want to welcome all of our visitors who are here today and to encourage you to think about becoming one of our members. We have very engaging lunches and receptions. You'll find on your table a membership application card, so take it home with you and give it serious consideration to joining us and being part of the Alaska World Affairs Council family. I want to thank everybody for coming, and I especially want to thank my friend Billy for being with us. He was in Paris one minute and Boston the next and D.C. and now here, and I picked him up late last night. We had a great dinner. It was great to catch up with him after not seeing him for a number of years. Lisa said that he was started his day at West High School, and he'll finish it up today at the Alaska Community Foundation, meeting with some folks there. So he's going to have a busy day, and it's great to see our guests come and not only speak to us, but to spend some time in our community. Billy is widely known in many circles because he's dared to dream big and act big. And when we hear him speak today, you'll find out that it's not just big, but really big. And admired for his courageous, for his courage to raise really tough questions, not just of national leaders, but all of us in this room and our friends and colleagues throughout this country, about some pretty simple but profound questions like, why do kids go hungry in this country? Why do they go hungry? With all the opulence and all the modern things in our country, why do they go hungry? And what do we do about it? What do we in this room do about it? starting in 1984 with his sister Debbie and a $2,000 cash advance, Billy has turned Share Our Strength into a national leader. Since that time, Share Our Strength has raised and invested more than $315 million in fighting hunger. He is the chairman of Community Wealth Ventures, a for-profit subsidiary of Share Our Strength that offers strategy and implementation services to foundations and nonprofit organizations, partnering them with them to design and implement innovative approaches to growth and sustainability to promote social change. He has worked with some of the country's leading chefs and restaurants and some of the biggest corporations to fight hunger in our country and elsewhere. In a previous life, which is when I met Billy, he worked for Senators Gary Hart of Colorado and Robert Kerry of Nebraska. He's the author of four books focused on social change. One of them is at the front. We encourage you to pick one up and perhaps get it, including Revolution of the Heart, Cathedral Within, The Light of Conscience, and his most recent book, The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men, which showcases the entrepreneurial strategies and qualities of character required to solve problems that affect people who are voiceless, vulnerable, and economically marginalized. Billy is a native of Pennsylvania. He earned his BA at the University of Pennsylvania and his law degree from George Washington University in D.C. He is the director of Timberland Company, or has been a director of the Timberland Company through 2001 and 2011. He was named one of America's best leaders in October 2005 by U.S. News and World Report, and most recently won an S. Roger Horchow Award for Greatest Public Service by a Private Citizen. He is here today to speak to us about the imaginations of unreasonable men and women and creating community change. So please give my friend Billy Shore a warm Alaska welcome.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you so much. Thank all of you for having me here today. This is a real treat for me. Lisa Falco, thank you so much for all the work that went into this and the great work of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Pat and I, as Pat said, we had a previous life in politics. I think during that campaign, we'd probably been to about 40 states together. And since that campaign, I'd been to 49, and the only one I hadn't been to was Alaska. And so when I got this invitation, I jumped at it. So it really is a treat to be here. I'm going to try to keep my comments somewhat concise, both so that we have some time for questions and conversation, but also as a result of a rather sobering conversation I recently had with my six-year-old son. I want to leave aside just for a moment the improbabilities of me having a six-year-old, which didn't seem improbable to me, actually, until through the magic of Facebook. As you know, you hear from people that you haven't heard from in at least 25 or 30 years when they find you there. And I got a note from a woman that I went to high school with named Melinda Greenberg, because my Facebook picture is myself, my wife Rosemary, and our son Nate. And Melinda looked at it and she fired off a Facebook message and she said, "I saw you on Facebook. Isn't it wonderful? I have a grandson too." And I was like, "No, actually." So I straightened her out. But the conversation, the sobering conversation with Nate, was a result of he had misbehaved with his babysitter for the first time. He's 6 years old. He's a great kid. He's just always been terrific. And he had misbehaved a little bit. And my wife was so distraught over this that she called me up at work, said I needed to come home early, that we needed to talk to Nate about his character and his purpose in life and the choices that he makes. And if you know my wife, you'd know that I had to really get home right away. So I did. And we had this conversation with him. It was kind of a monologue. Rosemary did most of the monologuing. And as is the case with, you know, six-year-olds, we were just kind of sitting on this little triangle on our living room floor, and Nate was very respectful. He didn't say a word. He was just kind of looking at us quietly. And at the end of the conversation, my wife had, I thought, the really good sense to say to Nate, "Now, Nate, is there anything in turn that you would like to say to us?" And he just looked us dead in the eye, and he said, "Thank you for your little presentation." So I'd... yeah, so I like to wrap up my comments before I evoke that with anybody, and I'll try to do that today. What I What I mostly want to talk about, and this feels like the right group of people to talk about it with, is for those of us who are engaged in the community as we are, how do we do the work that we're doing in ways that are more powerful and lasting and enduring? And many of us have been engaged in a variety of community efforts, some through politics, some through business, some through the nonprofit or other community organizations. And I think what many of us have found is that the toughest problems to solve are often those that affect people who are so vulnerable and voiceless and economically marginalized that there are no markets for solving them, which is why many community organizations and nonprofit and philanthropic institutions come together in the first place. But those institutions don't always have the tools and the resources they need to get the job done. One of my favorite New Yorker cartoons is of a husband and wife sitting in their living room on their easy chairs, and a puppy dog comes in and has its paws up, and the caption just reads, "Once again, I find myself in the rather awkward position of having to ask one of you for a biscuit." This is what life in the nonprofit sector can be like a lot. And what I really want to talk about is how do we change that dynamic? How do we do this work in a more powerful way? And of course, as you know, there's probably never been a time, there certainly hasn't in nearly three decades that I've been doing this, where the need in so many of our communities is greater than it is today. We've now got 46 million Americans living below the poverty line for the first time since records were kept over the last 52 years. Of those 46 million Americans, 20 million live in what we call deep poverty, which is a family of four living under half of the poverty line, so a family of four living under $11,000 a year. We have unemployment that, as was reaffirmed in this morning's release of statistics by the federal government, still stuck at 9.1%, with increasing numbers of people becoming permanently unemployable. And when it comes to hunger, which is the issue that I've worked most closely and directly on, we've got 45 million Americans on the food stamp program. We now call it SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. 45 million Americans on that program, and half of those are children, the greatest number since that program was created. At a dinner with the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, a few weeks ago, he told me that one of every two children in America today will be on food assistance at some point in their childhood. This is uncharted territory, folks. I mean, this is not a place that we have been before, and I think it raises questions for all of us of how do we do this work more powerfully, so this is not the situation that so many young kids and families find themselves struggling through. Issues of hunger, of course, are not just about hunger. They're about education and a child's ability to pay attention and to learn. They're about our economic competitiveness globally. And so as we think about those questions, I come to it from the taking some lessons from the very specific experience that I've had at Share Our Strength over the last few years. I'll give you just a kind of a quick snapshot of the organization so you get a sense of where I'm coming from on this. As Pat mentioned, I started Share Our Strength in 1984 with a $2,000 cash advance on a credit card. The catalyst at the time was the Ethiopian famine, which was this, as you know, this catastrophic humanitarian event in 1984 in which millions of people perished. And I wanted to think about how we could do something more hands-on and a little bit more direct. And one of the unusual things that we did with our $2,000 advance, $2,000 cash advance, is we had this ambition to be an organization that raises and distributes funds in the United States and around the world to fight hunger and poverty. But we wanted to be a grant maker to the most effective organizations doing that. What we did not want to be was a re-granter. We didn't want to go to the Community Foundation and say, could we have $30,000 so we could give $20,000 of it to the food bank? There seemed to be no value added there, and in fact, there seemed to be a little bit of value subtracted. So we made this kind of unorthodox decision, which was that even though we only had $2,000 and it wasn't going to last very long. We wouldn't have any government money. We wouldn't have any foundation money. We wouldn't have any direct mail. We wouldn't have a high donor program in the organization. And so we backed ourselves into a very tight corner, obviously. And what we knew at the time was that we, although we wanted to be a grant maker, we didn't want to be a re-granter, we didn't want to redistribute wealth, we wanted to see if we could create wealth for the community, because we didn't think that there was enough redistributed wealth to solve the problems. Instead of fighting for our share of the charitable pie, we wanted to see if we can make that pie grow. And so we started to try to think of ways in which we would, in effect, make money rather than redistribute it. And to make a long story short, we very methodically began to organize the restaurant and the food service industry all across the United States, thinking that chefs and restaurateurs made their livelihoods from food. They would feel connected to the issue of hunger. And that eventually started to take hold. We asked them to cook at food and wine benefits in which we raised funds. We asked them to donate excess food. We asked them to teach low-income families about nutrition education and food budgeting and grocery shopping skills, things which they had innate knowledge of. And we got to the point today where we have about 20,000 chefs and restaurateurs involved with Share Our Strength, now many others, and have raised, since the $2,000 cash advance, about $330 million. And our annual budget this year will be $37 million in just this year alone. But what we were doing for us felt like it was good, but not good enough. In fact, almost everybody was satisfied and enthusiastic about Share Our Strength's growth and the impact we were having and the funds that we were distributing to so many great organizations around the community. Everybody was satisfied, as I say, except for us. And we kept asking ourselves, is the glass half empty or is the glass half full? There's still a tremendous amount of need. And mostly, how do we scale up these programs that we know work? So one of the most maddening things about the issue of hunger in our country is that kids are not hungry because of a lack of food in the United States. Of course, we have food in abundance and we enjoy its blessings all of the time. Most of us do. Kids are not hungry because of the lack of food and nutrition programs. We have those too. We have the food stamp program and school breakfast and school lunch and other efforts. Kids are hungry because they lack access to those programs, which seems to be an incredibly lame reason or excuse for letting children not reach their full potential. When I say they lack access to those programs, I mean that literally. We have 20 million kids in the United States who, by virtue of their family's low income, get a free school lunch. All 20 million are eligible for a free school breakfast, but only 9 million get it. At lunchtime, they're already at school. At breakfast time, they have to get there earlier, and there's a set of complications around that. And when the schools are closed in the summer, although all 20 million are eligible, only 3 million get it. And so the most ironic part of all this is, in an era of almost nonstop budget battles at the federal, state, and local level, these programs are already authorized and appropriated and paid for. So the federal government reimburses 100% if we get more kids enrolled in these programs. And so we said to ourselves, okay, how do we scale up what we know works? And who else can we learn from that has done this in some interesting ways? That led me to a couple years worth of research and work around this this book that Pat mentioned called The Imaginations of Unreasonable Men. The gender bias is not mine. It takes its title from a George Bernard Shaw passage from Man and Superman, where one of the characters says, the reasonable man adapts himself to the world around him. The unreasonable man persists in trying to get the world to adapt itself to him. Therefore, all progress in changing the world depends on the unreasonable man. So I started to talk to folks about, who do you think is wrestling with this issue of how you solve these problems that affect people who are so marginalized there really are no markets for solving them? If there were a market for solving childhood hunger in the United States, some big Fortune 500 company would be in it. If they could make money doing it, I can assure you they would have found a way. But no, they've chosen not to, and they've left it to us and a lot of other organizations. The most profound example that I could find of this, and the one that I wanted to learn from, was the fact that 1 million children a year, mostly in Africa, die from a preventable and curable disease, malaria. And as I started to talk to global health experts, and as I started to talk to folks at the Gates Foundation, I started to talk to folks at a lot of other places, I started to think, well, that's an incredible example of a group for whom there is no market. These are poor kids far away from us in Africa. We tend not to think about who they are or what they need. And about 1 million of them die unnecessarily. And so I got interested in who was trying to do that, and particularly what kind of strategies they were using to attack that problem. One of the folks I talked to told me everything that was going on in the field, and then literally as she was getting up out of her chair, and she said, oh, and then there's that crazy thing that Steve Hoffman is doing. And she started to walk back to her desk and leave me out in the hall. And I said, no, wait, tell me, what is this crazy thing Steve Hoffman's doing? Well, I went to meet Steve Hoffman. It turns out he's got a laboratory about 20 minutes from where I lived in Silver Spring, Maryland for more than 25 years. It's in a strip mall. There's a photo framing store, there's a Hallmark card shop, there's a kitchen appliance store, and then there's one door through which you walk into a biohazard level 3, it's unmarked door of course, laboratory cultivating more malaria than anywhere else in the world for his experiments. And the first thing he said to me on the very first day was that the solution to a malaria vaccine was not scientific discovery. It was biotech engineering. We had things that worked, but we weren't able to get them to scale. And that resonated with me in terms of so many of the community efforts that I've been involved in. And what he was referring to specifically was a discovery that had come about in 1968 by two doctors at NYU, Ruth and Victor Nussenzweig, who found that if you took a mosquito infected with a malaria parasite, and if you radiate that mosquito to weaken the parasite, if you do that with about 1,000 of them, okay, to weaken the parasite, and then you take those same mosquitoes and you strap them in a box on Pat's arm and let them bite him for about an hour, that will be strong enough to trigger his immune system, but not strong enough to make him sick. So in other words, it would be a vaccine. Now, you can't immunize people by the bite of a mosquito, but Steve Hoffman has spent the last 10 or 15 years figuring out how to dissect mosquitoes. And so if you think of mosquito, and if you think of mosquito salivary glands where these parasites live, Steve Hoffman's idea, and the reason people said that crazy thing Steve Hoffman's doing, is that he had come up with a methodology for dissecting mosquito salivary glands. And what most people imagined was a room full of people in little white coats bent over doing this work. And when you go into his lab, what you find is a room full of people in white lab coats bent over dissecting mosquitoes by hand. And what he had decided that unreasonable, impractical, expensive, tedious, is still better than 1 million kids a year dying from malaria. Today, he's in clinical trials with what's considered to be the highest, most effective vaccine that's ever been. There's never been a vaccine for any parasitic disease. At the time I met him, he was in this strip mall. About 2 years after I met him, Bill Gates discovered him and gave him $34 million, and now he's got this state-of-the-art clinical manufacturing facility. But his notion that it wasn't a matter of scientific discovery, it was a matter of biotech engineering, and his notion that it may be expensive, the delivery system may be clunky and unreliable and complicated, is as true of the way we deliver education to kids in need, healthcare to kids in need, food to kids who are hungry. So I was really struck by this strategy, and we started to apply it at Share Our Strength. And I was also struck by the notion that most of our failures that we tend to think of as failures of money, if I'd only had more of time, if I'd only had more of strategy or planning, are almost always failures of imagination. Steve was able to overcome that failure of imagination. Nobody thought that what he was doing could be done. It seemed unreasonable and practical. In the same way, at Share Our Strength, literally taking a page from his book, we called together about 60 of our colleagues in the National Anti-Hunger Movement and Coalition, and we presented a plan after years and years and years of trying to feed children. We presented a plan by which we thought we could actually end childhood hunger by the year 2020. And of the 60 organizations in the room, about 59 of them were energetically and passionately opposed to our plan. they thought, well, it would cost a lot of money. We've never attempted something like that. What if we failed? What if we missed? Fundamentally, they were uncomfortable with the accountability to a very specific outcome. But slowly we brought them around. Slowly that leap of imagination had started to have its impact. The other thing that I'd learned from our work is the absolutely critical importance of thinking long-term for these efforts. As you know, these problems that we deal with, they didn't come about overnight, they don't go away overnight, and we have to find ways to sustain the people who have dedicated their lives and their careers to solving them so that they can attack these problems on the scale that they exist. We have found several strategies for doing that. I'll talk to you just about two of them and then open this up for conversation. One is a very simple one, and it's what I call bearing witness. Going out and making sure that you reconnect to that impulse that led you to this work or your work in the first place. I ended up in Ethiopia after the famine. I ended up in Haiti 2 weeks after the earthquake 18 months ago, not because I thought I could change anything there, but because I was certain that I would be changed by what I saw and what I felt and what I knew needed to be done. We often talk about experiences we've had, and we tell people that we saw something or we did something that moved us. And I love to think about that in the most literal sense, because when we say we're moved, what we're really saying is that we started out in one place and we ended up in another. And that is the fundamental core of all personal and social transformation. So to put ourselves in positions where we can go out and bear witness and reconnect to those impulses is vital. But I think the other thing that's so important is to think about our work, and this relates to a book I'd written earlier called The Cathedral Within, to think about our work the way the really the great cathedral builders did. I opened up here this afternoon by talking about how do we do work that's enduring and lasting and inspiring. And as part of that search, I started to think about, well, who has done that? And I got very interested in the great cathedrals of the world, because I knew that they took hundreds and hundreds of years to build, and many of them are around 1,000 years later. So what can we say that's even analogous to that in our lives? And so I literally took some time off and I started to go visit the great cathedrals, and I started in the U.S. at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine and St. Patrick's, and then I went to Notre Dame in Paris, and I ended up at the Cathedral in Milan, which is the second largest Gothic cathedral in the world. It was started in 1330, it was finished in 1843, and it has a museum in the basement, and I thought I would go study it for a few days and try to learn what was the ethic that enabled them to create something so magnificent and inspiring and enduring. The two quick things I'll tell you about it is just before I went to the cathedral, I gave a talk to the employees of the Timberland Company, the boot and clothing company that's based up in New Hampshire, and as a thank you, they gave me this beautiful leather jacket, and it had this furry collar on it, and it was the best Timberland leather. It had my name stitched inside of it, and I thought, well, I'm headed to Italy in February, and it's going to be cold, and if I put on a leather jacket, maybe I'll look Italian and fit right in, and this is going to solve a whole lot of problems for me at once. And I did that, and I went and I studied this cathedral for a few days, and on my last day, right before I was supposed to fly home, I went to take one more look at it, and I'm standing in this big, broad square, kind of a piazza, maybe 10 times the size of this room or 100 times the size of this room, and way off in the corner, I see two young and very attractive women who seem to be excited about me or my Timberland jacket. I'm not sure which, but I can see that they're pointing at me, and then unlike all of my experience with women, instead of walking away from me, they actually start to walk towards me. So I think, well, this is going to be a different experience. And they come up, they don't speak any English, and I don't speak any Italian. But they're kind of, it turns out it's the jacket, sure enough, and they're oohing and aahing and kind of fussing over it and touching it and rubbing the fur. And one of the women picks up my sleeve to her lips and she kisses it, at which point I think, these guys from Timberland know how to make jackets. Well, within 30 seconds, they had picked my pockets clean, my passport, my wallet, the whole thing. So that was the one of the two important lessons I learned at the Cathedral of Milan. And Chose not to put that actually in the book, The Cathedral Within. The second, and hopefully more relevant to why we're here today, is I really tried to understand that feeling you have when you walk into a cathedral, because you know you walk in and there's this architecture that compels you to look upward, and you have this almost this sense of constriction in your chest. You know, you kind of gasp. They're so magnificent, and they're of course bricks and stone and glass, but you also know that they're more than bricks and stone and glass. There had to be some tremendous force of humanity marshaled to build a cathedral that was started in 1330 and finished in 1843. There had to be some tremendous unleashing of energy in such an effort. And for a cathedral started in 1330 and finished 513 years later in 1843, the only thing that everybody who worked on that cathedral could have known for certain, and of course was generations and generations and generations, the only thing they could have known for sure across those 513 years was that they would not see their work finished in their lifetime. That was a given. And that did not detract from their dedication or craftsmanship or commitment. It actually enhanced it. They knew that, like those of us who have come together in this room today, that they were part of something larger than themselves. They were part of a community, and that what they were doing made sense, whether the polls said it was popular or not, whether the economy was roaring or stagnant, whether it was politically in vogue. Just like so many people in this room who I suspect like the cathedral builders who put brick upon brick upon brick, who go to one more meeting, send one more email, help with one more fundraiser. They were doing it simply because it was the right thing to do. Somebody who spoke about cathedral building very eloquently, more than I could be, was Dr. Martin Luther King. He didn't use the word cathedrals, but he came very close. And he said just 4 weeks before he was killed in a sermon that he was giving, he said, "So many times in life we start out building temples. Temples of character, temples of justice, and temples of peace." And he said, so many times those temples go unfinished. Life is like Schubert's unfinished symphony that way, and the most agonizing thing about life is that which is most precious for us to finish is often unfinishable. But Dr. King concluded by saying, "That's okay. That's the story of life. What makes me happy is when I hear that voice cry out across the vista of time, that voice that says, it may not come today, and it may not come tomorrow, but it is good that it was within thine heart. You may not see all of your dreams achieved, nor all of your desires become reality, but it is good that it was within thine heart." Thank you for having it within your hearts to be doing the work you're doing in this community, and thanks for inviting me here today. Thank you. Thank you. So do we have time for any questions or comments, Lisa? Arguments? I think there's one in the back.
Thank you. Very thoughtful comments. I read a lot of what Michael Pollan writes about nutritious food as opposed to the processed and very cheap stuff that we call food. Could you speak to farm price supports and the impact on both food availability and quality?
Well, I probably can't speak to the farm price supports as well as I can speak to the fact that the food quality and the nutritional quality is a huge issue in all of the programs that I mentioned. I've literally been in schools where you would think twice about trying to get more kids into the school lunch program because the food was so bad and looked so unhealthy for the kids. One of the things we've done is we've created a nutrition education program. It's about 15 years old now, called Cooking Matters, in which, again, chefs and restaurateurs teach families about nutrition education, something, grocery shopping skills and food budgeting, something as simple as if you know how to carve up a chicken, you can buy a chicken whole, which, and if you're on food stamps, you could save a couple dollars doing that. There's always been a divide in kind of in a political sense, between anti-hunger organizations and nutrition advocates. They've felt threatened by each other, at least the anti-hunger organizations have, and we've said that's not right, that nutrition has to be a core component of any anti-hunger effort. There's a huge movement in this regard, with chefs and others getting involved in schools, sometimes actually taking over the food service at school systems. One of the unfortunate aspects of the legislative and the political process, though, is that in many cases, like in the Farm Bill, there are efforts to fund different programs like price supports by cutting things like food stamps. So you end up with this real serious internal division. But it's, you know, the hardest part of this, I guess, and I neglected to say it when I was talking earlier, is that, you know, for the kids involved in these programs, and for the kids who suffer as the result of lack of nutritional quality or even lack of access to the food, the real issue, of course, is not just that they're vulnerable, but that they're voiceless. And this is, I feel like, the opportunity that all of us in this room have. You know, I was saying earlier to some folks that I've talked to a number of governors, probably a dozen or so governors in the last year or so, to talk about how many kids they've left out of their state's programs, and Alaska has a very significant issue around that as well. But just to use Colorado as an example, they've left $71 million on the table. And when I told that to Governor Ritter, who was governor at the time, he said, how could that possibly be the case? And his staff, you know, kind of shrugged, and he said, well, why did we need this fellow from Washington to come tell us this? And I said, you know, respectfully, if it had been a defense contract for $71 million earmarked for Colorado, somebody would have been in this governor's office a long time before I was. These kids, you know, obviously they don't vote, they don't make political campaign contributions, they don't belong to organizations, and they don't have lobbyists. So, you know, the nutritional issue is wrapped up in that same issue, which is why we've got to find a way to be a voice for them. To me, there's no greater testament to their voicelessness than that there's a bucket of $71 million in just one state alone, and billions of dollars when you add it up, that's been authorized and appropriated, and they can't benefit from it. Sir.
We've had thousands of nonprofit organizations, thousands of churches for numbers of years working on the problem of childhood hunger, poverty. The problem keeps getting worse. You said that you met with the Secretary of Agriculture, who said that one out of two children will be on food stamps. What does the Secretary of Agriculture think the role of the federal government is in helping to solve the problem?
Well, I would say that I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think he would say that, you know, the programs like school lunch, school breakfast, and summer meals are administered through the Department of Agriculture, and so he would say that their role is to get more kids involved in these programs. One of the things that we've wrestled with is, and your question, I think, you know, kind of gets at it, is what is the right balance between private organizations and nonprofit organizations, church groups, community organizations, and the government's role? And I think there's got to be, frankly, a very tight link between the two of them. One of the things that I've experienced firsthand is that, you know, as a nonprofit organization, there are things, I think, really important things that we can do that the government cannot do. We can innovate. We can take risks. We can be closer to the people we serve and learn how to serve them better. But when it comes to really scaling that up to make sure that everybody who needs the product or service that we've developed can get it, then I think you have to have a role for public policy in the government. And one of the really frustrating things about this particular moment in time is that it's become really politically incorrect and almost considered naive to even talk about issues of poverty. So at the same time that we've got the greatest divergence in wealth and income and the greatest increase in poverty in the country, nobody's talking about it. I grew up in an age where presidents declared wars on poverty, and there were commissions, and there was legislation. When President Obama gave a State of the Union speech this year, it was only the second time in history that a Democratic president didn't mention the word poverty. I don't say that so much as a knock on Obama, who I admire in a lot of ways, but more as kind of a sign of our times. Yesterday in the New York Times, there was a story about his campaign manager, David Plouffe, saying, he said, one of the things that Obama's candidacy offers is the promise of a president who will make every single decision based on what's best for the middle class. Now, the middle class has their needs and wants, and they're legitimate, and I'm part of that middle class, and I get that. But how would you feel if you read that and you're not part of the middle class? And again, it was, you know, we're just in this era where people don't want to talk about these issues, and I think we have to find ways to connect them, not just on what I think of as a moral basis, but again, on a practical basis. We want to be a global economic power and leave, you know, 46 million people behind. It's not going to happen that way. But to me, it feels like a very different time than those that I remembered. Other, sir.
Actually, sort of a two-part question. First of all, you've talked about how the initial impulse, that first $2,000, came because you were focused on wanting to do something about Ethiopia. And there seems to be this sort of reverberation between what happens outside and what's happening domestically. So if you could talk about that a bit. And then you mentioned the meeting with the 60 organizations and the goal of you know, eliminating the problem by 2020, and people asking, what happens if you fail? What happens if you succeed?
Right. Well, so as I mentioned, we started, the catalyst was the Ethiopian famine. Actually, my experience, and, you know, Pat could probably testify to this probably even better than I could, is in all the years that I worked for Senator Hart, my kind of conditioned reflex was, when I read anything in the paper, to think about how Senator Hart should respond. What should he say, and should he do a press release, should he introduce a bill, is it consistent with what he said before, and so forth. So you're almost conditioned to think for somebody else rather than for yourself. When I read this headline in the papers, it was right after the Democratic Convention in 1984, when Hart had come in second to Mondale, and there was a story that said 200,000 to die this summer in Ethiopia, and I was really struck by it. And then I was struck by the fact that I'd had a thought of my own for the first time in about 8 years, because I wasn't thinking about what should Hart say. I was just thinking, I was horrified by this catastrophe. So I thought, you're thinking for yourself. You should stick with that for a few minutes at least. And created Share Our Strength with the idea that we would focus internationally. At the same time, it was in the middle of President Reagan's two terms. There were all these budget cuts in the United States. A lot of people were hurting here, and we decided that we needed to also be focused here. It's very difficult. And one of the challenges that we found, and I'd say that we have not succeeded at yet, in the same way that we're succeeding domestically, is how do you create a constituency of people who care about what's going on half a world away? You know, if I went and polled all the various stakeholders of Share Our Strength, and it's hard to generalize, you know, extremely high percentage of them would say, you know, I want to make sure everything we're doing stays here in our own backyard. And I appreciate that and respect that, because we've got great needs here. But I also want to find a way to help people see the connection between what goes on around the world and what we need. And as to your question as to what if we succeed, that's actually a really important question for us. We got to this issue of childhood hunger by thinking about something that the writer and activist Jonathan Kozol talks about a lot. He says you should pick battles that are important enough to matter but small enough to win. And I really love that construct, and I think it's related to the first part of your question, because there's a lot of things around the world that we'd all like to make a difference on, and we know that 2 billion people on the planet live under a dollar a day, and that there's these enormous needs. When we started to really drill down in a very kind of dedicated, serious way, what is a battle that's important enough to matter but small enough to win? We thought childhood hunger was one of those. And when we do win, I don't think we pack up and go home. I think we have, hopefully, the credibility and the resources and the bona fides to go climb the next higher hill.
Very,
First, I want to let you know that I purposely wore my Timberland shoes today.
Thank you.
Now I know to be wary of anybody who admires them. You've spoken very inspirationally and to some degree on a global basis. What do you tell communities and what do you want to tell us that we can do right here for the issue that's here in Anchorage and in Alaska?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, to me, the most important thing certainly that distinguished the issue of hunger from, again, so many other things that I care about and I suspect you do as well, is it is a problem with a solution. This is not rocket science. This is not trying to come up with a vaccine for AIDS or something else that might be beyond our particular abilities. This is an issue with a solution, and it's an issue that virtually everybody can participate in. You know, first and foremost, one of the things I have found is that by talking to elected officials, in some ways, we're pushing against an open door. I mean, I told this story about Governor Ritter not knowing that the $71 million was available. We've had the same experience with Republican governors, Democratic governors, men and women. Most elected officials, before they get whatever happens to them once they get in office, I think most come in the door wanting to do the right thing, especially for, you know, vulnerable populations if they can. Ideology gets mixed up in that and other things. But we have found that when we go and talk to them, we say this program is available, it works. And by the way, these programs that I'm talking about, school lunch, school breakfast, SNAP, they've been around for more than 35 years. They have bipartisan support. This goes back to Bob Dole and George McGovern together saying, you know, we can do this together. And there's still, that legacy is still very strong in Congress. So you have quite a bit of Republican and Democratic support for them. So many people are so skeptical, though, as you know better than I, that any government program can work or make a difference. That again, in kind of the Jonathan Kozel, big enough to matter, small enough to win, we see these as a good way of demonstrating that, you know, there are things that work, and let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. If we're going to, you know, get rid of waste, get rid of inefficiency and all that kind of stuff, fine. But for those things that work, so I think, you know, having the opportunity, whether it's at the school district level, the county, you know, state, city, what have you, can be very powerful. Most elected officials I have found are just completely swamped by the incoming, and the incoming tends to be people who have access to them and voices louder than the voices we're talking about. Not, you know, not to mention all of the private efforts, food banks, soup kitchens, things like that, that could use support.
I'm wondering if you've had any success in your experience engaging youth, peer groups, adolescents, you know, even elementary school children.
We have. We've tried to engage some youth in very specific ways, you know, that I would say, frankly, are mostly introductory in terms of them just getting involved and getting familiar with the issue. So we've created, you know, we started as an organization, I mentioned, by working with these chefs and restaurateurs, and then we realized that there obviously are lots of other potential supporters that want to get involved, and we started to create different kinds of platforms for them. For children, we've created something called the Great American Bake Sale, and every year we have somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 families all across the country that participate in bake sales. The real idea, frankly, is not so much the money that it raises, although it raises a couple million dollars that we grant out, you know, 100% of, but the real idea is for kids to have the opportunity to get familiar with the materials and to get a little bit familiar with the issue as it affects their local community. My own kids have participated in it, and then they tend to, you know, get mail and other stuff that just helps, you know, kind of acclimate them to the fact that not everybody has the advantages they do.
Economist magazine, in their most recent issue, did a study of fertility worldwide, and they found that it dropped almost 50% in the last 20 years. You see a ray of hope here for poverty situation?
I see a couple rays of hope. Some has to do with that statistic that you mentioned in terms of the drop in fertility, and a lot has to do with things that technology is enabling us to do to create more and more affordable food for people. So, for example, this morning a friend who runs an organization called Project Healthy Children, which is involved in my micronutrient fortification. Things like in this country we take for granted that we put iodine in salt. In a lot of countries they don't do this. They're going around in a very highly leveraged way in terms of the return that they get on their investment, and getting governments of other nations to understand the power of this in terms of the health of their population. So I think that, as well as, you know, other ways in which we're finding that we can irrigate, grow foods, things like that. Yeah, I am hopeful. Again, the challenge will be, are these technologies put to use for the people that need them the most, or are they put to use in other ways that are, you know, probably more marginal for those folks?
Thank you very much for your comments. I think if we were in less polite society, I would enjoy engaging you on some of your analogies. For example, the Milanese cathedral, that really was a business enterprise over the centuries, that there were various forms of profit, but many people who were poorly fed and clothed supported that project with their labor. In our schools, which was another area we went, there's also a business model at work, which I think greatly contributes to malnutrition, and profit is the motive. At Diamond High School, where I taught, the lunch options were limited to what we would call junk food, and the machines were well stocked with candy and soda, because it's big business. So I'm wondering, with your six-year-old, what do you think? Do you think it'll be a moral structure that you're talking about, an unselfish one? Or do you think the paradigm will be pure profit?
Well, it's a great question. I'll tell you what I'd like to think could happen. And this is, of course, kind of a tension that has existed, as you point out, for hundreds of years. One of the things that I think we have to do, those of us who are engaged in community, and I talked about, a little bit about this notion of when we started Share Our Strength, we wanted to not just fight for our share of the charitable pie, we wanted to make that pie grow. I think that those of us in the nonprofit sector have to think of nonprofit as a tax status, not a management philosophy. And I think we have to find ways to marshal the incentives that are used in the for-profit sector to get things done. I think that's doable without greed having to overtake it. When you look at, we were talking about this a little earlier today, when you look at the disparity in most companies between the level of wealth created for a handful of people at the top of the company and the, you know, almost paltry amount of resources that go to everybody else in those companies, not to mention their vendors and suppliers and stuff that's outsourced, it's a shocking disparity. At the same time, I think there are things to be learned from the for-profit sector about how you get a good idea to scale and how you create incentives, not to get rich, but to use market forces so that you reach the largest number of people. You know, we can, so for example, we know that through FedEx, right, we know how to trace a package anywhere in the world, and we can do it on our iPhone to find out if something got somewhere. They had a lot of market incentives, right? They got very, very wealthy through the profit in doing that. We have so many communities in this country where we have no idea whether kids have been vaccinated or not with basic vaccines. That's a package. It's a package of medicine, can be traced the same way. But we haven't figured out how to create the market incentives to do that. So, obviously, I think most of us would say we're going to raise our kids in a way that they have some sense of the moral and ethical, you know, boundaries and balances that we want them to create. At the same time, I want them to, if they have an idea that is good for people, I want them to learn as much as they can about how to reach the most people you can reach from it. So I think there are some aspects of, you know, what we would call capitalism that can be, I guess, that have been perverted and that can be restored to their rightful place. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, Billy Shore, as always, thank you from all of us in the audience and from the Alaska World Affairs Council Board for being here and sharing your creative visions on how to deal with poverty. And I think that's the message we're going to wrap up with today is the reason we're here is for you out here in the audience in the Anchorage community to bring a perspective that's very unique that you don't get in the mass media. And we hope that your continued support will come forward over the next few months. And I wanted to thank, again, our new partnership with the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation and Bill Popp for helping us move this perspective to the Anchorage community forward, and, of course, the Anchorage Community Foundation as well. We also have some other things coming up here. We have our next program with Ambassador Peck coming up on October 21st, so please put that on your calendars. And he'll be talking about the outcome or output of the Arab Spring. And then coming up, another partnership that the Alaska World Affairs Council has formed is with North Rim Bank. And we will be putting on an oil and gas series starting in November, November 4th. We have coming here to Anchorage and speaking to the community, the oil minister from Norway. So it'll be great insight on how Norway gets to do their business in the oil patch. And so Billy, in memory of your visit here to Anchorage, and we hope you come back again, we have a bit of a pictorial representation of Anchorage.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us. And if you would, if you've got a minute, please take some time to fill out the sort of evaluation questionnaire on speakers that we have here. Three times a month, and that'll help us build our program as well. And with that, I think the meeting's adjourned, so thank you very much for attending, and we'll see you next time, October 21st.